Sorry about that.
There was a chemist named Walter Mahler who had invented or discovered that under certain conditions he could produce iridescent materials like in liquid crystals that were hard, not fluid. So you could actually coat some of these onto a surface, and by heating them and applying pressure, they would form very beautiful iridescent patterns. And so my boss, Bill Remington, said, well, why don't you look and see if we could develop some products based on that, and we decided to give this a name, call it Irlux, iridescent light, and started embarking on that, and we got made some quantities of material, had a couple of chemists work on developing them. And then there was a development conference with General Motors, where I went to it and tried to interest them in Irlux. And, they were very interested, and they wanted to hear all about it, and could we come out to Detroit to make a car that looked psychedelic with all the iridescent colors. Somewhere during that conference, I met up with a man named Bob Ellison, who had been a designer, and his past work was designing leather patterns for Corfam. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of looking for something new to do because Corfam was about to expire. And he came over to me and said, Ralph, this is something that's exciting. Let's meet and have lunch. Well, I'll take you to lunch. Well, lunch with Bob Ellison always was a 2 or 3 martini affair. But he was very creative. And I told him what I had done with Dilux. And he said, could you put Dilux on shoe leather? I said, sure. He said, well, why don't we do that? So he got me some leather, and we coated it, and we created all sorts of patterns. He said, that's fantastic. Why don't we go to New York? And we talked to a couple of people in the shoe leather business. So we went off to New York, and we talked to a lady named Nancy, I think Cook, but I'm not sure, who had been the designer of the Clark Desert shoe. I mean, she was one of the foremost shoe designers. And well, she thought, boy, you could put all these fancy patterns on shoe leather, on leather. This would be interesting because you could print things on demand and also. So all of a sudden, a new concept was created, photo decoration. And Ellison, who knew all sorts of people in the company, had a contact with a group in Greensboro, North Carolina, who were in the furniture business. DuPont sold lacquers for furniture in those days. So Ellison and I went down to Greensboro, and we showed them what you could do with Dilux. And the people were, oh, this is great. We can now use plywood and produce a pattern on it, just as I showed you. Mm-hmm. And before long, we had a half a dozen people working in Greensboro trying to develop lacquers that could be applied to plywood or composition board for patterns on wood. And the advantage, of course, was we could produce inlay patterns. You didn't have to glue anything together. We could do it all photographically and high quality. And this thing went on, and all of a sudden, we had in OrCam, we had a small group, maybe 5 people working with us to develop these markets. So we were in the shoe leather and furniture business. And I was having a great time because it was new. These were people who were used to having nice expense accounts to travel with. You could eat well, you could go in and stay. Everybody was very excited about it. Well, unfortunately, at some point, DuPont decided the furniture business was no longer of any interest to them. And even though we had a line going into Thomasville, which was a major furniture manufacturer, who had already bought equipment to make photosensitive tabletops, this project got killed. Mm-hmm. And then
Now, when something like that happens, like Thomasville had had made a commitment because they had, as you said, they bought equipment to do this. And DuPont makes a decision to kill the project. Who makes that decision? How does that actually...
Well, upper management makes a decision based on whatever information is fed to them. And frequently this means that you have to pay people for equipment that they had bought. We had to pay for Thomasville putting in some equipment. And it doesn't help your reputation. I mean, this is one of the great problems of building, of being a material supplier, because you need other people to build equipment for your materials. And then if you don't make the materials anymore, they're very angry with you. And this happened, and this happened to us certainly here. We also we spent a lot of time and energy trying to decorate leather, and again that closed. I mean, the interesting thing with leather was, I don't know if you know that, when a hide, animal hide, is used, it is split into, it's sort of split like, this is the upper and this is the lower. Yeah. Did you know that?
It sounds somewhat familiar, but...
Yeah. Well, for instance, you know about hush puppy shoes and things like that, they use the split. They don't use the top grain. The top grain has the pattern, but the split doesn't. So if you could create a leather pattern on the split by a coating of a polyurethane with a photographic image of a leather, you'd have a you could have two high-value things from one split. So the leather industry that we spoke with were very interested in what we could do. And it seemed, you know, a rational opportunity. But our leaders didn't have the patience to develop it. And then, of course, one of the problems was DuPont likes to work with companies, or in those days, like to work with companies who are big in their field, like Boeing or General Electric, and they don't like to work with little guys who make leather patterns or something like that. So this tends to be somewhat of a problem. Anyway, we had enough license then to examine other markets, and then along came something called Photomarker, which we're making patterns for cutting clothing. These were not for home use, but for industry use. For instance, when garments are cut, they take a whole stack of pieces of fabric, and they mount a sort of a paper pattern on top of it, and then the cutter goes through it. And actually, there was a company that was very close to where you work now. It's called PMC, I think. I don't know if you've seen it. It's next to the Boers. It's a big clothing manufacturer there, and we market tested a light sensitive paper with them. But the company that was going to develop it was a small company in New York, and we had a very good relationship, and it pleased me because it gave me lots of excuses to go to New York. But the product was to come on the market just about the time when interest rates were about 20% and they couldn't finance it. So you run into these problems perpetually. Well, in 1976, I got a phone call I got a phone call from one of my friends and said, guess what, they're finally going to put somebody into a marketing position in Photo Products who supposedly knows what he's doing, and he's going to help you expand markets. I said, oh, that's great. So I called up this man, his name was Philip Botsolas, Botsolas, was a remarkable person. And I called him up and I said, I hear you're coming. He said, yeah, I heard about you, Rolf. And I said, well, I tend to be quite enthusiastic about this technology, and I'm glad if I ever find somebody who's enthusiastic. He said, Rolf, if you're not enthusiastic about what you're working on, you're not worth it. This is going to be interesting. So we had a we got together in Wilmington, and I showed him what I was doing. He was a little skeptical. I mean, everybody always said, well, if these ideas are so good, why doesn't anybody do anything? Well, it turned out I didn't have the authority to do more than suggest the market, and you need support from upper management to get out there. But anyway, yes, first thing we went to was we had found a man down at Georgetown Medical School who wanted to do barcodes on samples that were taken out of patients. Of course, he was predicted the right thing. Mm-hmm. And he had seen a machine that was called the DuPont Automatic Clinical Analyzer. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ACA, as it was called, was invented somewhere in the early 60s. It was a wonderful machine where the patient, where fluids from patients, urine or blood or whatever, could be analyzed automatically. It involved some color-changing reactions. And the fellow who was really the brains behind that was a man named Don Johnson, who, believe it or not, also went to Wisconsin and was my upstairs neighbor.
Oh.
When we both came to Wilmington. Well, Don, this machine was quite successful, and it had one very nice feature. It printed out the results on Dilux paper. And the way it worked was this. The nurse would take a small transparent pouch and insert this alleged, say, sample of urine. And there would be pots on the pouch, and the machine would squeeze these pots and then would give a color reaction for this, that, or the other thing. And attached to the pouch was a translucent sheet of Mylar film. And the nurse would write the name of the patient on that transparent sheet with a marker or a pen. And then when the analysis was complete, the pouch and the sample would be in contact with the UV light over a piece of Dilux. And so this handwritten information would be transposed to the sheet on which the results were printed. So you basically had a foolproof method of transferring information. And this, at its height, consumed about $3 million worth of Dilux every year. So that was a market for us, and it was internal. And every time somebody did an analysis, they used Dilux paper. So this gentleman down at Georgetown had the idea that we could use this technology to make barcode contact prints. Earlier, I had been asked to go to a meeting in New York where the supermarket industry was discussing the future of barcodes. And this was at the Plaza Hotel. It was very enjoyable. And I suddenly realized there was a great opportunity for printing barcodes using Dilux. And basically, in those days, they had barcodes were supposed to be on the bottom of each item. And there were some items that were very hard to print on, like bottles. And so companies like PepsiCo and Tropicana and so on came to us and asked us if we could squirt Dilux onto the bottom of orange juice containers or glass bottles. Glass bottles are very non-flat at the bottom. And then optically print barcodes. So here we had a blue and white image, which was ideal because they used a helium neon laser. So this was really great. But it seemed there was a better opportunity even in barcode for items that would be marked in the store. For instance, meat products or dairy products that are different weight. So the people in our film department, at that time we had a film department, who was involved in selling packaging films to the meat and dairy industries and so, said, oh, can you print barcode labels on dialogues? I said, sure. So we had a new opportunity, and so we decided, well, we would go to the biggest manufacturer of weighing scales, which was Hobart, in Dayton, Ohio, and we showed them what you could do with dialects. And our analysis was that there would be, at that time, there were 30,000 supermarkets in the store, in the country. They weighed about 2 million items a year, so you had a huge number of labels that had to be printed, and they could all be printed on dialects. And we thought, well, the barcode would be about an inch and a half square. So this turned out to be about a $60 million business. So that was pretty good. Well, when we tried to sell that to our bosses, one guy said, my wife would never buy anything in a supermarket that didn't have a price on it. Everybody said, have you ever been in a supermarket? Well, my wife does all the shopping. I mean, the idea of barcodes for everything was totally foreign to people in 1972-73. And so we thought there was an opportunity here, and then as we went to Hobart, we told them what we could print optically without any waste and label that would be stable. And the chairman of the board put his arm around my shoulder and said, Ralph, I'm glad you came here. So we worked with Hobart for a number of years, and then DuPont decided they didn't want to go into that business. And we had gotten some patents on some ideas on label printing and so on, but nothing came of it. And I mean, this was a sort of disappointment in my career that we had all these opportunities to pursue, and for some reason, they got killed.
And you had very little, I mean, you had very little explanation on your end as to...
Well, the companies had said, well, this is not a business we want to get into. We don't have a marketing organization to support this. And I mean, throughout my life, I found it's easy to invent things. And you have no problem getting support for inventing things. But then when you try to commercialize things, then you talk about real dollars. And you need different skills, and some of those aren't available, and they have to hire new people, and they have to find new locations and buy new equipment, and all of a sudden, research chemists in those days might have cost $100,000 or $200,000 a year, but when you try to develop a product, now you're talking about millions of dollars, and of course in a company that is relatively risk-averse, as DuPont is or was, those are hard things to fight. And I mean, and I think the lack of experience in different businesses always hurt us. I mean, we were fortunate in the proofing business that we had John DeCampi and me to a certain extent, and a high level of enthusiasm and being able to go out to people. And I mean, one of the ways that DuPont marketed things often is they go to companies with secrecy agreements and say, we'd like to show you something. What do you think about it? And we did this, I had one remarkable experience that was in 1969. It was about 2 or 3 months after Wortel came into the program. I was involved in going to St. Louis to visit some Air Force lab, and they somehow canceled the visit after we got to St. Louis. So the tech rep whom I was going to go with said, well, why don't we go and visit a couple of printing companies and see whether they have any interest in what you have. So we went to one company and said, we would like to show you this. And we had these little printers like I showed you yesterday, so you could demonstrate that. And the manager of that plant said, boys, I'd like to buy your lunch. Well, that seldom happens that somebody else buys your lunch. He said, you don't want to know what my opinion is of DuPont. I said, Well, yes, he said, if they don't know what to do with this and have to come to ask us what to do with it, they're even dumber than I think they are. So I thought this was a great plus. So then we went to another company, same thing, and this, and I remember we had to go to the third floor of an office building where the manager sat, and I had to lug this little printer up three flights. They were heavy, and the tech rep who accompanied me said, we'd like to show you a new product from DuPont. And the manager said, listen, guys, I'm up to my eyeballs in work. Come back some other time. I said, can you give me 1 minute? And he said, okay. So I made a proof for him in 1 minute. He said, Sonny, I got all afternoon. And he said, listen, there's a club, the Printers Club of St. Louis is meeting tonight. Can I borrow your equipment? I promise not to keep it. I'll give it back to you tomorrow, but I want to show everybody what you can do. And he said, look, we printers, we're not competitors. Everybody is in some other aspect of printing. So this will make it for a lively evening. So I picked it up the following morning. He said, for God's sake, just make the stuff for people in St. Louis. And I called up Bill Wortel and I said, listen, we can sell all the paper we can make in St. Louis. Why don't we start making it? And Bill believed me. And he started the wheels rolling, and we didn't have any coding equipment. We had to go to another company in Massachusetts to do the coding, but that sort of started it. So, I mean, this business of finding the right person in another company to work with to do the right level of PR and so on is very important. Well, anyway, so...
Do you think that... I mean, you said that in some ways invention is easy, but the commercialization is hard.
Yeah.
I guess in some ways I would imagine that a company like DuPont would have an advantage over a small company or an individual in commercialization because they do have marketing experience. They do have resources.
Yeah. Well.
But do you think, or in your experience, is there just a certain amount of inflexibility? I mean, like you said, they don't want to work, or they didn't want to work with small companies. They only wanted to work with kind of the big companies. They were very conservative in their choices.
No.
So was there just an inability at the upper management level to see some of those risks as
worth it, maybe? I think the one thing that was brought out in this book about Bell Labs was they could invent things because they had a rich backer, AT&T. They didn't have to worry about funding from day to day. And for a while at DuPont, this was also the case. I mean, we had, the company was generous, and I would say as long as the DuPont family owned the company, really owned the company, which was until around 1970s or so. I think there was a great emphasis on long-term results. In the more recent past, the results, the short-term results, ever so much more important than they used to be. I mean, all of the people that I know who work for DuPont now, I mean, they're working on three or six-month cycles for product development. Well, if we can't do that in 3 months, then maybe we should do something else. And of course, who is to know at what point it should stop? So I think the you know, every morning when the DuPont company wakes up, they have spent millions of dollars to keep all the office buildings, all the experimental station, all the factories, and so on. So they have to produce revenue and produce a fairly high level of revenue to support all this. And in my opinion, good things, bringing good things to the market takes time. I mean, it took us from the time we could have had the first Dilux, could have been in 1963, and we didn't get on the market until 1969. And I had another case in point. In 1975, I invented a new photo initiator, which was patentable. The patents didn't issue until 1981 and 82, but it wasn't until around 1984, that this material was used. In other words, it took us from the time we decided we would use this new initiator to the time it had replaced all the old initiator. That's 4 years. And part of it, because we had to do all the environmental testing, we had to do market studies of how cheap or how expensive it was, we had to make endless comparisons. Now, I asked some of the upper management why it took so long. And they couldn't figure it out, but it is just a large company tends to be slow. Now, I think a lot of this has changed now. There's a lot less middle management to slow things down than there used to be. So maybe somebody has learned. But anyway, we found out then that as time went on, what was very important was to get equipment out that employed, was designed for our products. As I showed you yesterday, two different light sources are visible in the UV are responsible for the imaging or the deactivation. And in the graphic arts field, up to that time, up until we came along, could be used one intense light source which had both UV and visible light. So when you expose the material with both, it images a little, it fixes a little, but it doesn't really do what you want. So we had to persuade people to use buy equipment that was rich in black light, rich in ultraviolet light, and we found some companies that will make it. We found the man who built that little printer for us, started a family business to make equipment for DuPont and customers. But somewhere along the line, somebody said, you know, if we had a filter, we could use a xenon lamp, which is both rich in UV, and a filter, a glass filter, to separate the wavelength so that only UV or only visible would come around. And actually we found out early in the game that there was a company in Kokomo, Indiana called the Kokomo Church Glass Company, mm-hmm. who made a cobalt filter that suited our purpose. And so we used that filter. We gave hundreds of pounds of that filter away, and people interposed that into between the light source and the paper to generate relatively pure UV. But then there was the need to develop a flexible filter so that people who had roll-through devices, you know, they put in things and it comes out. And then we were given the task of whether we could develop a color filter that would absorb visible and pass UV. And I had collaborated for much of my technical life with a very talented woman chemist named Kay Looney, who was a spectroscopist. And I gave her several dyes that might work, and she measured the spectra and optimized the system, and we came up with a flexible filter where people could simply interpose that between broadband light sources and the light-sensitive material. So, I mean, it was a matter of identifying opportunities that would enhance the product, and that worked. Kay Looney was sort of interesting. She had worked at Central Research when I first met her, had left the company to have children. I found out she was still interested in science. I got her hired as a consultant. She came and contributed hugely to our success. And we remained friends for a goodly number of years. Unfortunately, she died about 3 years ago. And we had, as time went on, then in Philip Gonzalez, who I spoke of, was this enthusiastic character, slowly became convinced that maybe what I was saying was right, that we weren't getting the right kind of support. And I once said, I have a good slogan for Dialux: we don't need any development, and we're surely not getting any. But so next thing that happened was there was a gentleman named Glenn Thomas, who was a rising star in Ford Products Department, and he was sort of a marketing expert. And so he and I and Gonzalez had a meeting, and Glenn said, Ralph, we'd known each other for a long time. He said, look, you've done all these things, and nothing's ever come of them except for a paper. And I made the comment, I said, Glenn, you don't know, goddamn well know what you're talking about. 2 weeks later, Glenn was my new boss. But I must say, he was very supportive, but he was my boss, so I think he probably realized it. Well, anyway, Gonzalez then decided Ralph Dessauer should be working for Ford Products, but they couldn't get me in because Bob Upson didn't like me. So Gonzalez said, well, why don't we write a couple of projects that would, where Ford Products would pay Orkamp to do the research. So I said, fine. And we decided that if we could make a four-color proof, that would be great. And if we had really black paper, that was great, because our paper was sort of olive black. And in proofing, in color proofing, there are several products that require more or less time to make a proof, but you basically deal with four negatives, one for making a cyan printing plate, a magenta printing plate, a yellow printing plate, and a black plate. So the question was, could you develop a Dialux film that would produce these colors, and then you could overlay them to see a color proof? And I said, oh, sure, I could do that. I did it. Well, it turned out the guy who was the general manager of Ford Products was a very nice gentleman named Philip Wingate. And I had known Wingate. He had actually been in Orkham a long time earlier. And Wingate would come. I would occasionally meet Wingate when I picked up my mail at the post office in Greenwell. So Wingate would say, oh, what's new? I kept on saying, what's new with Dialux? And so one day I said, well, I'm going to wait and see if I can intercept Wingate at the post office and show him what we had done. And he was very receptive, and then we got the money to do the research on color Dialux from Wingate, so it involved personal relationships. Well, in 78, Upson retired, and then they took me into Ford Products, and they had me work there, and except for the initial reception, which wasn't all that glorious, it was pretty good. They were very, in Orkham, if you had a good project, you'd get as many technicians as you need at that time. I mean, when I was in that final stage in Orkham before I transferred, I had three lab technicians and Kay Looney and another chemist working for me. So it was, when I went to Ford Products, they said, well, everybody gets a half a chemist. I thought, a half a technician. I thought, it's idiotic. Here's a person who's an expert in the field, has worked in this field 20 or 30 years, and he's down to being just like a new hire who gets a half a technician. But anyway, we struggled on, and then gradually Ford Products changed, we got to the point where we developed new proofing system, tried to develop new proofing system using electrophotography, which still used these chemicals. And then at one point there was a director, he was an assistant director, but a lot of directors, who felt that I should have gotten a more of a reward than I did for my contributions to that point. And he initiated that, and I did get a fairly sizable chunk of money somewhat late in my life in 1986, and another promotion. And then I went, then DuPont and Xerox formed a joint venture, which they called DX Imaging, which was be located in Lionville, Pennsylvania, and we developed some exciting new technology, and I think we did very well, but at some point in time, DuPont lost patience with us or didn't have the money to support it, and we had a falling out with Xerox on top of it, and so DXI closed up, and I suddenly was retired. It wasn't too bad, though, because the day afterwards I was consulting for my friends in Towanda on Dilux, and I found out that way I could consult for a lot of people, and I wound up consulting for Xerox, for Polaroid, for International Paper Company, and so on and so forth. That was pretty good. And the most exciting consultation was with Hewlett-Packard. One day
so
I get
let me just understand. This is about 1987?
1991.
1991, okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
I should say that, to put this in some chronological order, in 1987 I had worked for DuPont for 35 years, and if I joined DX Imaging, I could get my pension and a full salary, so that sounded very inviting.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty good deal.
So I decided I'd retire from DuPont, and I had assumed that DXI would last 10 years, but it didn't, unfortunately. We were sort of interesting. I were talking about this yesterday, connections. Now, in 1969, when Bill Wortel sent me to Europe to look for markets for Dilux there, when I was in Munich, the DuPont company hired a young physicist to take me around and to a couple of companies like Oseram and a couple of printers. And I kind of liked the guy, so my wife, Nikki, came along with me. And so I said, well, we ought to invite the Ebbings for dinner. So we took them out to a very nice dinner, and then I met Mrs. Ebbing, and she said, oh, you have to come to our house for dinner. So we went to her house for dinner, so we became lifelong friends. And in 1990, Angela came to the United States to learn English better. I mean, she and her husband own a small company that made very sophisticated electronic equipment for measuring toner quality. And she felt she was doing all the correspondence. Her English wasn't very good, so she came over, stayed in New Jersey for a couple of weeks, then called me up and said, I thought you can stay here. I've got a big house. I was widowed at the time. And 3 months later, we decided to get married. So if it hadn't been for all this technology, I wouldn't have married Angela. So it's sort of funny. And there are lots of little coincidences like this. Also in, 1991 we got married, and 1991 I started what I thought was a really nice consulting activity, and the people from DuPont were, well, at that point my relationship with DuPont was really great. They were very generous in consulting fees and supplied me with chemicals, so I had to use my laundry room upstairs to mix things, and I was so familiar with these things, I knew what was toxic and what was not. I'm still alive. I mean,
it worked out.
I've had one cancer operation, but not too bad. And so I feel I was fortunate. And but I said the most interesting consulting activity was with Hewlett-Packard. This was in 2002. Get a phone call from Hewlett-Packard, and they say, are you interested in consulting with us? And I said, oh, sure. Well, what about? Well, we can't tell you. We have to sign some agreement first. Well, okay, so they emailed me some agreement. I signed them. And then we had a long conference call. And what they wanted was to, they said, we have a technology which does what we want to do, but we'd like to know how quickly somebody who is a possible competitor could develop technology that would surpass what we have. Would you be interested in working on that? I'm not sure. And then they read me the requirement. They said, well, all right, we'd like you to, this was on a, I think maybe a Wednesday, can you come out next week, make a proposal of what you want to do? We want three different ideas. They should be patentable, and we'll give you 6 months to do this. And I said, well, why not? And then they sent out a guy to coach me on how to address their project.
Wow.
And then Angela and I flew out to Portland and went to Corvallis, which is a lovely city. And I had a very nice relationship. I worked for them for 6 months. I got two patent applications out of it. One patent is issued. Mm-hmm. They were happy with me and gave me a couple of printers. It was really enjoyable. The people there were very nice. They treated me like I was an expert on something. And it was very good. I had another situation this sort of necessary to do some publishing now and then so people know you. And I had, if you look over there, there's a couple of things that I have written in addition to the book. And you see the imaging processes.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a chapter in there with Kay Looney. The green copy was my first volume of Advanced in Photochemistry on photochromism. The second, the one over that is on Advanced in Photochemistry, where actually I have the whole dialogue story mm-hmm. as a personal memoir, which was sort of unusual, a technical book to put something that's personal in there, but
yeah.
I did. Then I wrote the book for Elsevier,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm trying to write an electronic book on color, which I'm not sure where it's going. It's very, I enjoy writing it, though. I go down to Apple a couple of times a week in the Christiana Mall, and they help me with it. And what I'm trying to do is reduce words to graphics, animated graphics, whenever possible. And people who, with the exception of the people at Chemical Heritage Foundation who have seen it, think it's very good. I haven't had any. I wanted to give it to Chemical Heritage, and they haven't had any enthusiasm for it. I don't know why.
Well, we're not really in the education business very much.
Well, I find, for instance, if they could mount it over that exhibit in your museum on the color, it would tell people a lot more than the exhibit would. I mean, I'm still going to propose doing that. And for instance, one thing that's very disappointing in this whole exhibit there, they don't have one single chemical structure, you know? I mean, you know, this is chemistry, and it ought to have a chemical symbol there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much more than you can show, so I'm still going to see if I can pass it on to someone. But I think it's important for, as much as it's difficult, to get patents and to get your name out so that at some point, if you want to consult, people know about you. And I was fortunate they knew about me. And I had a nice career. I felt, to me, the chemistry is still interesting. I wouldn't mind going back to work. I mean, I find retirement is too strenuous. You don't have time for anything. I mean, I find my days. I mean, I work on my electronic book. I work on my I do some consulting still for a company that is working on waveguides, and I try to read and, you know, stay abreast of technology. There's one very interesting sidelight to all this. I don't know, did we talk about watermarks at all yesterday or not?
We didn't.
No, because that's sort of interesting. Postage stamps used to employ watermarks. Paper used to have watermarks on it, so as security. And classically, the way you see whether you have a watermark was to hold it up, dip it in a piece of, in a little bit of benzene, and hold it up against the light. And the somewhat transparency that is created makes it possible to see if there's a watermark. One of my friends who was a stamp collector came to me once and said, "Do you think I could use Dilux to record watermarks?" In other words, put the stamp over a piece of Dilux paper, shine light through it, and get a record of it. I think it takes a long time, but if you got, he said, "I got time." So he actually found out that watermarks could be recorded on Dilux from stamps. Well, he sold his stamp collection, but he got very involved in going to places like the Library of Congress, Winterthur Museum here, and so on, to record papers, to record watermarks on old paper documents and so on. And all of a sudden, and he published, he published wherever he could, and we went to all sorts of places together, like the Fosser Shakespeare Library, and we watermarked some of Shakespeare's folios and things like that. And Tom passed away a few years ago, and in the meantime, I decided, well, maybe with my expertise on dialects and having a stamp collection, I would become an expert on watermarks and stamps. And I have probably the only collection of watermarks of the stamps of Bermuda that anybody in the world has. Obviously I have Dilux material so I can make them. And it's sort of interesting because stamps used to be produced on sheet-fed presses, so you know, that means you put a sheet into the press and so on instead of rolling through. So sometimes the sheet would get put in upside down. Right? So sometimes the stamp is a great deal more valuable because of the watermark being inverted or otherwise displaced. So I have a nice collection of miswatermarked stamps, and I think something hope to sell that. So anyway, I'm still kept fairly busy and don't get around to doing a lot of things that Angela wants me to do, but we I think are reasonably content with what we've achieved.
You guys do a fair bit of traveling as well.
Pardon?
You do a fair bit of traveling?
Well, I would say we, because my wife's family is in Germany, almost all actually. We used to go to Europe once or twice a year, but I think in recent years my enthusiasm for traveling to Europe has been somewhat diminished. I find everything connected with flying has become a pain.
Mm-hmm.
So our usual travel is to drive down to Florida and get on a cruise ship and spend a couple of weeks on a cruise and then go travel around Florida for a time. And I have no problem traveling by car, but I find everything connected with flying has become a misery.
Yeah.
The only enjoyable flight I've had in recent years was quite an adventure. I took ill on a cruise ship, and they flew me back to the United States in a private jet.
Oh, wow.
It was not the ideal way to travel, but, I mean, it was a nice flight.
Yeah.
But I find we used to go to New York a lot. I think we go less. We go to Philadelphia a great deal. I would say almost once a week. We like to eat out. We I find the days are never long enough, and unfortunately, there's too much to do. I don't read scientific journals a lot anymore, hardly. I look at CND News quite thoroughly. I do follow the literature on biomedical chemistry. I check the patents every once in a while and have a big tabulation of all the patents. Mm-hmm. And I have also a fairly long collection of all the chem abstracts literature that is in the end. I don't know that it's of any importance except to give you the feeling, well, you know, this is something that I should know more about, and I intend, time permitting, to write a section on biomedical chemistry for Wikipedia. They don't have it yet. I think what we had was, you know, I've periodically given talks. One thing that was very enjoyable was, I mentioned yesterday, Professor Neckes at Bowling Green, and he had invited me for a week to give 5 lectures on whatever I wanted to talk about. So I gave a lecture on dyes, a lecture on dialox, and so on and so forth. And I've been out to Bowling Green a number of times and given talks. The last technical talk I gave was on the occasion of his 70th birthday. They had a symposium, and I talked about some chemistry that was practically unreported using this technology that I still don't understand, and nobody else does. I mean, we have a system where you could mix 2 chemicals, of which one of them was a biomedicinal, of course, and depending on the ratio that you mix them, and, well, you have another ingredient there, a plasticizer. Depending on the ratio that you have, it, when you expose it to the light, it either changes from tacky to non-tacky, or from non-tacky, from tacky to non-tacky, or the other way around. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, I have no explanation why that is, and I haven't found anybody who has. I hope that if I talk about it long enough, somebody would take it up, but nobody has, so here we go.
I'm curious, you know, you have this education focus, kind of in the things you've been involved in after you retired, but were you involved at all in any kind of mentoring, too? You had an opportunity through a really long career to interact with a lot of different people.
Well, I mean, there are some people who claim or accuse me of having taught them everything they know about this, that, or the other thing. Whether that's facetious or not, I don't know. I feel that for a long time, the people in Towanda who were, you know, who didn't have all the background that I did, and who were then in charge of manufacturing Dilux, would call me when they had problems, or they would ask me to give talks or so. Through my post-DuPont career, I gave a lot of talks at DuPont about certain aspects of this technology or so. The unfortunate thing is, for instance, in certain areas, like dyes and pigments, the technology has really moved to China and to India. So there are fewer and fewer people who really know the difference between this, that, and the other thing. It's, you know, it's you can't be expert on everything. And so I probably know more about dyes and photochemistry than a great many people. I don't know everything, of course. But, I mean, I could make useful contributions if somebody wants to know. But, now that, you know, the industry has moved offshore, the universities don't teach color chemistry anymore either. I mean, even when I was in Wisconsin, there was only one course by a professor that dealt with dyes. And bad dyes were basically the beginning of organic chemistry. I mean,
right.
Everything that came even the pharmaceutical industry came from came out of dyes. I don't know if you know that. Going back to my father's professor Early,
mm-hmm.
although I think he probably didn't know my father, he started off staining bacteria, and then he found that if you put some arsenic into some of the molecules, they would stain and maybe kill them. And that worked pretty well. And that was the beginning of pharmaceutical chemistry. And I think probably with one of the problems with chemistry nowadays is that if you have a new material in hand, it's years before it has passed all the tests, so people don't like to make new materials except in the pharmaceutical industry, and you wind up more people who measure things and do different kinds of chemistry from when I grew up. I mean, I always thought you could solve most problems by synthesizing the molecule that would do what you wanted to do.
Right.
And this is no longer the case. I mean, when we started on this whole business here, we thought, well, you could make a molecule that works with UV. And we found that, well, it had a tail that was a little into the visible spectrum. So I thought, well, damn it, we're good enough chemists. We could design a molecule where the tail has disappeared. Well, we never did. But, I mean, that was the attitude we had in those days. But nowadays, you wouldn't approve that. You'd mix some other things in it, and the whole chemistry would change. The real question or contribution that I made, I think, was I kept the thing alive. I felt I kept on finding people who were supportive. I think I was always honest about the limitations, although possibly somebody occasionally misunderstood me. I felt, given enough resources, we could have done much more, much better. I mean, there were other opportunities. Now, you have to recognize that inkjet didn't exist before 1976. And inkjet did not, and inkjet will do many of the same things that we could do here, and a lot of them perhaps even better. What it couldn't do was to shine light to form color through a negative. Improving the negative is important because that's how you make your printing plate. So if you had a negative, doing anything with inkjet wouldn't work. But now people proof using cathode ray tubes, displays, or not, television monitors and so on, to show a result. So, I mean, these are all new developments, and probably if we had come up with Dilux now, we wouldn't have had the proofing because other technologies have surpassed us. I mean, there was no electrophotography to speak of when we started. There were no computers. So we were fortunate that what we had invented fit in at the right time. What always troubled me was that in the way that research at the DuPont company is structured is that after a while, when a project closes, it's all forgotten and people move on to other things and they can't remember. And if you ask them 5 years later, do you remember what you did here? And they say, well, maybe it's in my report. But they don't necessarily have the continuity and interacted with what else has happened since then. So if you're in a situation where right now somebody comes up and says, gee whiz, could you do that? They'd have to go to me or probably no one because there wouldn't be anyone to know what else we did then. So this question of whether you can maintain a stewardship in an area for technology past its original lifetime. Maybe it's a luxury, maybe it's not, but I think it's something to consider. I'm blessed with a good memory, and I always seem to remember things in the past so well. Other people have a very great talent. They can exclude things that happened at a certain time, and they don't worry about it anymore.
Do you think that the need to commercialize products at DuPont forces people to just keep moving forward with something and hinders their ability to really concentrate on something for, you know, 15 or 20 years? I mean, if you were going to work on something for 15 or 20 years, you're going to remember a lot more of the details, where if you only get to work on something for 1, 2, or 3 years, maybe.
Well, I think that... thank you. The question really is, how does the company innovate? And let's just say you and I are the head of this large company that has lots of money, and we say, well, we want to make something that is really super duper that the world needs. So first of all, where do we get the idea what the world needs? I mean, it's damn hard to come up with a $50 million idea. It's probably hard to come up with a $10 million idea, but $50 million is even... But in my days, the company said if it wasn't a $100 million idea, it was really not pursuing, worth pursuing. And this is... And part of the problem was, well, it's inventing another nylon or another Orlon. It's a very formidable task. And... And then you go up against the establishment, which feels threatened because we've been selling this nylon, this Orlon, so why do you want to come up with another fiber?
Right.
So you've got all these internal issues, which I don't know how you solve them. I mean, I remember one occasion, by that time I'd perhaps gotten a little bit of a reputation of being innovative, and somebody came and visited me and said, well, I'm supposed to look at new opportunities, and how do you do it? I said, I think you've got to be the right person for it. And let me ask you one thing. Do you own a VCR? This was maybe 1980. You know, he didn't own a VCR. Do you own a computer? No, I don't own a computer. And I kept on asking him something else. I said, you're a nice guy, but somehow you're not immersed in new technology at home. So how can you be very immersed in technology for the company? And so, I knew one example. Once upon a time, there was a wonderful man named Bill Phillips, who was in Century Research, and he was a physical chemist, and he probably had the first NMR machine that anybody in a commercial laboratory had in this country. And did some very, very impressive work, and people were all overwhelmed by how good he was. And he was a nice man, really bright, and I found I could talk to him about things that was sort of like a scientific bull session. I'd say, can you do that? And then he would say something that would inspire me to something else, and we became pretty good friends. And then all of a sudden, the company decided to send him to MIT for a year, to work on essentially the intersection of biology and chemistry. And he spent 1 year and then got to a job as planning opportunities. And I think that was a good thing, whether all the things that have happened since in that field can be attributed to Bill Phillips or not, I don't know. Unfortunately, he left DuPont, became a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and died. So, I don't know. You can't ask him. I found a couple of people whom I knew were creative in that sense. I met one man who had developed an idea of using liquid toner for electrophotography, and he attributed all sorts of wondrous things to that that you could not do with powder toners. And he actually talked DuPont, Xerox and Harris printing, or whatever they call it, into a joint venture, which ultimately became DX Imaging, mm-hmm. where we were trying to use liquid toners for making proofs. And we made some beautiful proofs, so great idea. He had his own company in Israel named Indigo. He sold the company to Hewlett-Packard for $1 billion. And now he's off onto something else called nanography, where he's trying to, I think, marry nanochemistry with all sorts of printing opportunities. I haven't seen him for a number of years now. He is a man who's probably in his 70s now, but who has, through his personal inventiveness and cleverness, developed new technology, but always in an area in which he had some knowledge. I mean, he didn't go off and make better bananas or something like that. So I think the question really is how do you develop enough expertise in somebody that he can see an opportunity for technology that he is familiar with. And I don't know if somebody said to me right now, what would you like to work on next? Well, I mean, there are lots of things that haven't been colored terribly well, like cement, or
But I've spoken with some other people through these oral histories about innovation in the chemical industry, and one person remarked that over the last 30 years or so, there's been an interesting move in the chemical industry to, instead of just coming up with new ideas and then trying to force them on a market, trying to look at a particular market and see what they're missing. You know, as you just said, cement hasn't been colored very well, and there are probably a lot of ways in which people would like to use colored cement better. Yeah. You know, that would be an opportunity for a market. But even with the people that we talk to in oral history and, you know, people having these good ideas, there is still this problem that we mentioned earlier, that overall these companies are conservative, that they are risk averse.
Yeah.
No matter how much they want to innovate.
Have you read Steve Jobs' book?
I haven't. I've heard all about it. My husband gave me a summary pretty much every day that he was reading it, because he liked it so much.
Well, I mean, obviously Steve Jobs wouldn't have lasted 2 days at DuPont. That's a given. How come Apple is as successful as they have been? And you do need people who are geniuses to do these mega advances. I mean, I don't know how you nurture someone like that in a company like DuPont. I mean, I found. You know, if you say, who are your heroes in the DuPont company? Bill Bortel, who managed to take a marketing group that was pretty well demoralized because things weren't happening. He listened to people, and he was dynamic. I mean, he gave a talk to our group on a day in which I wasn't there, and one of my friends said, you're going to have a hard time, he doesn't like you. And I went into his office first opportunity I had, and I said, I understand you made some comments about me. And he was a little evasive, and I said, well, it doesn't matter. I think you ought to hear my story before you pass judgment. He said, what are you doing to dinner tonight? I said, I'll call my wife and tell her I'm having dinner with you. And we were at the DuPont Country Club until midnight, and he put his arm around my shoulder. He said, I hear you, buddy. And after the following day, all the work on the venture simulator ceased, and six people who had done nothing but crank out numbers to put in a computer were suddenly employed in new activities, and all of a sudden things started moving. So He was great. My friend George Correa, Bill died, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago. Friend George Correa died last year. He was an individual who could listen to people. He was technically very savvy. He was willing to do his homework. He was willing to learn. And he was, and he encouraged people to do what they felt they had to do in order to do a good job. And it was routine in our group when somebody new came in that you gave him 3 or 4 months to work, to read the literature and to talk to people, and not to have to invent something the first or second day you were there. That's not heard of anymore in a company that, you know, assesses merit of everything on a weekly basis. Philip Bazzalis was a man who, he had been a district manager in a fairly high position in New Jersey, but he was a very combative person. I mean, he had a tremendous work ethic. He would be up in the dawn and late at night for whatever he believed in. I remember one time we went on a coding trial in Tawanda, where he decided he wanted to see what we were doing, and well, the coder broke down. He got us in the car. I said, "We go home." I said, "Do you want to eat?" He said, "We don't deserve it." I said, "Look, we didn't do it." We went home. I was enthusiastic about working with him, and we remained friends until he died about 3 years ago. Al McLaughlin was a man of, one of the few people I knew who could actually work on a lot of different areas and was smart enough and studious enough that he would learn enough about it to do whatever had to be done. He was a very good chemist. And
The pathway that you showed us the slide of earlier, that the McLaughlin,
yeah,
that's the McLaughlin that you're talking about?
And I found the interview on my hobby book with him to be, here's a guy who's very enthusiastic, realistic, knows his limitations, or knew his limitations. He's done very well. Sesh Khan, who was a very excellent chemist, who was willing to listen to people, was just a pleasant person. Bob Cohen was there; he was very good. We had good people. We had nemesis too. I mean, there was another. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm not drinking fast enough. Thank you. DuPont had commissioned two historians to write a history of scientific research at the DuPont Company. Are you familiar with that?
I don't think so.
Smith and Hounsbury.
I'm not familiar.
Well, my humble opinion, not very good. And I can only talk about the areas which I'm familiar with. And I think what they did was they interviewed managers who managed to give themselves a lot of credit for whatever happened. And one man who looks like he was the rising star of everything was a gentleman named Abe Cohen. Now, Abe was a very good guy, shouldn't diminish it. He had lots of ideas. He was very innovative. But he was a person who was difficult to work with. He did not give other people credit for what he claimed credit for, and we were sort of contemporaries for much of the time, and Abe just couldn't listen. I mean, he was full of ideas, and if you talked, it just interrupted his ideas. He didn't like that, and he believed that almost everything could be done with photopolymerization, from curing syphilis to flying to the moon. Fortunately, he found out about bimidazoles, which made it possible, but he never gave anybody credit for the bimidazole work. If we had succeeded in establishing a good relationship with him, we would have invented better thimidazoles that would have made for a lot better products and would have done things we couldn't have done otherwise. I had a number of bosses who I thought were very bright. I found generally they did a good job, but I felt in most cases they didn't risk getting fired for the things, for putting, you know, for solidly supporting either their co-workers or themselves. In other words, for instance, when DXI closed up, there was a question of what to do, and I was very disappointed because suddenly I was going to be unemployed. I didn't realize what was ahead of me. And so I photographed everybody who was there. There were about 90 people. I took my video camera. And I want to ask you a question. Do you think we could have succeeded? Well, that's the subject of maybe a book someday if I have lived long enough. It's sort of interesting. And with the exception of one person, we all thought we could maybe get to the market with what we were developing if we had another year. What we were working on was a big machine, which was originally supposed to cost $100,000, which later cost $200,000. That would take a piece of film. I'm sorry, would take four lithographic negatives, and convert and make proofs using electrophotography on plain paper. And I mean, this sounds, it was a big machine, and I have pictures of it somewhere. And we had about 200, at the time we closed down, we had 200 people working on it. So I was working on the films that were required to, as intermediate from the photographic negative to the paper. The rest of the group I was in was working on liquid toners, and they did a good job. So we, I mused about it, and I thought, well, we had eight machines that we had built, and they were pretty good, solid machines. One of them had been flown to Europe for a trade show, where we actually found people who wanted to buy it. And I don't think it was a big deal making the film, because I knew how to do that, and I figured the liquid toner we could get made, because that was no technology that at least was documented. So I thought, well, why don't I buy three machines and start myself a business. My assets were not used. I probably would have had to mortgage this house heavily, but I thought it would be an interesting idea. And maybe, and I mean, the DuPont philosophy was always to work with the uppermost technology to see how that we had the highest quality. I said, well, maybe we could find a middle ground for people who weren't intensely interested in having something that was perfect, but something that was good enough for their market, and we knew there would be people like that. So I said, why don't I buy the machine? Three machines, and I figured if I get three machines, and I could hire a couple of my fellow employees and pay them about as much as they were getting before and cut them in on the profits, I might have a business. So I thought that sounded sort of good, and I did all sorts of, I worked a month on spreadsheets proving how successful we could get government support and doing it in Chester, which is a depressed area. I mean, we all figured out. My main concern was there wasn't a heck of a lot for me to do, because we had enough material technology developed that wasn't the limitation. But I thought this would be fun. So, our business manager at that time was a man named Coleman, who was Ellen's husband. So I said, Mike, when we talk about this, he said, well, I'm very busy. I said, well, I'm going to come over for breakfast and let's talk about it. So he did dutifully come here for breakfast, but he wouldn't sell me any machines, and the machines were all stamped to death in an automobile graveyard. And I said, look, I mean, what a glorious opportunity if this thing succeeds. DuPont can buy it back from me, and if it fails, no loss. Well, they were more interested in the tax write-off, I suspect, than in in making me rich. So here, you know, people, I mean, there are a lot of people who I think, you know, want to make things go and try very hard, and a lot of them have, you know, I'm sure there are dozens of people in the DuPont Company who have similar dedication to what they have done and believe that what they did should have been commercialized or should have been made into successful products, and they have a hard time. And maybe it's good that they have a hard time, because probably a lot of those ideas aren't so good. Mm-hmm. You don't know. But my disappointment is that nobody's ever asked, you know, at a upper management level, how the hell did you guys do this? Because I think we pulled off, it was quite a remarkable achievement. We took some chemistry that we had intended for a particular opportunity, expanded it, developed a whole flock of products that used the technology, made a great deal of money, and what else can they ask for? Mm-hmm. And as I said, I had a good time. And, would I tell anybody else to do the same thing? Probably. It'd be fun, but I think the parameters for everything have changed. I mean, life is so different. And I still have some friends who are my age or a little younger, and we often talk, should we have become chemists or not? I still think I would like to be a chemist, but a lot of people don't.
No, your friends say they would.
No,
and I choose something different.
I meet with a group of people for whom I was associated with at the Wilmington Ski Club. Years ago, we have lunch once a month or so. I mean, this is sort of, I guess, fashionable for retirees. And I find the questions inevitably discussions deal with issues of health, but nobody was very interested in talking about science. I still interested in science. I still like to watch NOVA whenever possible, and I'm still happy when I consult with someone. And I'm really happy when I write books or mm-hmm. so on. So I find some people apparently retain this youthful enthusiasm, and others move on to other things. I think I'd be happy to go back to work. It's probably still interesting.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't.
Well, I think our questions are, you know, kind of over with. So is there anything else you would like to add or anything we didn't discuss?
Let me think. I feel a couple of things are important in my career, at least. One was I had fairly good health all the time. That's important. You have to be able to concentrate on what you're doing and not be worried about pain or agony. I think it's helpful if you have enough resources that you can risk getting fired if you get into too much difficulty. I think it's important to cultivate friendships with people who are similar to you. I'm still good friends with Rudy Paris, whom has been involved with the Chemical Heritage Foundation and got me involved with it. I think it's probably nice to live in an area where you have access to things like Chemical Heritage Foundation or University of Delaware or whatever, that you can interact with people who have similar interests. I think my educational background Well, it was good enough for the job that I was to do. I found very few people, with the exception of this director of research of photo products, Upson, whom I really had difficulty with. I don't know what I really bothered him about me, but he sure was bothered. And he was not a popular person, and I couldn't understand why. There are lots of stories about how unpleasant he was to other people, so I wasn't unique in this. I mean, for instance, I mentioned that Phil Wingate, who was the boss of Photo Products, got us the money to do the research, but I needed a lab where one could do photochemistry in, and such labs were available at the experimental station, but he arranged for me not to get one. So they had, actually, after we got the project approved, we had to build a photochemistry lab over at Jackson Lab, which cost a great deal of money and time and delayed any work. So that meant, really, in many ways, I thought it was evil. And I'm sort of glad I outlived him so I could tell the world what an evil SOB he was. I never found anybody who liked him. But there were lots of people to like, so, well, I don't, too bad. One thing that sort of was interesting, a few years ago I went, the question was, what do I do with all the notes that I had collected for my book? And somebody suggested I go to Hagley. Now, you're familiar with Hagley, mm-hmm. of course, mm-hmm. both yes. of you. We know Hagley was started as a repository for the records of the DuPont Company.
Mm-hmm.
And when the building was finally open and they wanted to get the records, the DuPont lawyers decided they would have to go over every document that they turn over before they could do that. So they weren't very interested. DuPont decided not to do that. And I had to go to Hagley. That was about 25, 30 years ago with my friend Tom Gravel in connection with the watermarks. And the then director of Hagley and I had a nice chat, and I said, I'm collecting a lot of stuff. Can I ultimately deposit that at Hagley? He said, oh yes, we can take private donations. So about 3 years ago, I went over to Hagley and I talked to Lynn Calabrese, and she said, oh yeah, why don't we, I said, would you like to come over here and see what I have? And she said, you know, we don't have any record of any chemist, you know, his papers and achievements and so on, so we'd be very glad to take them. And so I turned over 12 boxes of loose leaf notebooks, and I have now gotten through two of those boxes, and I have been making an index of the various contents of these. Now, unfortunately, we have another 12 boxes sitting in the garage, so at the rate I'm going, I have to be about 140 years old before I complete my task at Haskell. But, you know, I fear, for instance, I've saved these samples that I showed you yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday somebody would be interested, or maybe not. Or maybe someday somebody might want an exhibit or something like that. I think it might make an interesting exhibit at Hagley sometime. I mean, at Chemical Heritage, mm-hmm. if they wanted. Because these are visual things that you can see. And so, you know, on one hand, you take a lot of grief at home. Why are you saving all that? And on the other hand, it is of some cultural value, I think, for us to preserve these things. You know, if Mrs. Gutenberg had said to her husband, forget this printing press business.
And, would we be?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to start my book, and I think I actually did in a way. The different people approached a company like DuPont with inventions. And so the first guy was Thomas Edison. So I said, "Tom, what have you got?" "I've got a light bulb." "What, a light bulb? It means it's not very heavy bulb?" And he said, no, it's on the gives off light, you know, so you can see at night. "Why do you want to see at night?" "Well, you got kerosene lamps. If the Lord had wanted us to see at night, he could have turned the solar system up. There would be little all of them. And then, well, how does this damn thing work? Well, you have wires, and you bring electricity to the lamp. What do you do with all those wires?" "Well, you put them on the floor and put something over them. Or maybe you can put them on the wall. And the wall, you know, that's hazardous. Suppose a fire breaks out, or you have short circuit, and the house breaks down, we'd be sued. And by the way, how do you know that this light bulb isn't going to affect people's eyesight? You know, there's a big danger in all these people suing this company because their eyes have been ruined." So the next guy comes in, was Henry Ford. And, "Henry, what you got?" "Got a car, automobile." "Where is it?" "It's outside." "Well, can't you bring it in?" "Well, it's outside. So what are you going to do with it?" "Well, it's got an internal combustion engine and it runs, you have to have some gasoline in it." "Does that gasoline burn?" "Yeah, it even is explosive." "You want people to ride on 20 gallons of an explosive mixture that's very hazardous? And where are you going to go? Aren't you happy where you are?" He said, "Well, I know we have, we don't have any roads for these automobiles. Why don't you come back when the roads are built? Let us know whether there's any business for the automobile. You can take almost any invention if you're clever enough to do this." And I think Bob Newhart used to do that. I don't know if you remember Bob Newhart. I mean, I remember he had a couple of episodes. I thought, boy, I could have given him material. And, for every enthusiast, there are probably five people who are naysayers. And corporate naysayers, they can sink something irretrievably. And this makes it more difficult for the innovators. And I think that probably culturally, the period when we did all much of the good work in 1960-65, really I think was a time, it was post-Sputnik, it was people interested in science. I think it, for company at that time still had a reputation that people really wanted to come to work for DuPont. We got good, very good people. I mentioned that yesterday that, you know, we had people coming in on weekends and nights to work on this thing because they were so interested. And I don't see that kind of enthusiasm anymore, but maybe it's there, and I just don't know. But I think on a personal level, I had a good time, and it was financially reasonably rewarding. I mean, we lived fairly well, and I think that the question is, what else could we have done? And why didn't we? And that's unanswerable. But the question is, what do I do with all the stuff I've got? And I hope Hagley will continue to be a repository. But I don't even really know exactly how to handle Hagley in the best way. Do you know Eric Rao?
No.
Well, he's the new director of the library. And I've talked to him, and I was sort of wasn't quite sure, because I figured if I give them my papers, that they belong to them, and whatever I want to do with them needs their approval. And I still want to do something. Couple of weeks ago, they had a very small symposium, and there was a man from the University of Georgia there named Usselman. Does that name ring any bell?
Mm-hmm.
And I was discussing basically the issue of time relative to invention. How long does it take to bring things to fruition? I thought I had some sight, I could have some supportive data, so I thought maybe I could get someone to study this. If maybe, I don't know if it's worthwhile. I just think this was an eminently so successful thing that somebody ought to get something out of it that they could apply to another area or another activity, and whether that's just personal self-aggrandizement or whether it's real, I don't know. I mean, what I would take out of it was simply that we were fortunate we could interact with people who could contribute, and they were not necessarily part of the team, but they were interested in science and what we were doing. So, I guess I have told you in some detail some of the things that I felt or know. If you wish, particularly for the file document that you have, I will give you an image that you could include in it if you like, a piece of dialect paper.
That would be wonderful.
And I showed you this morning some of the slides that I have on it, and if you wish, I could give you a DVD with some of this information on it, and then we can refer to it if you think that's...
Absolutely.
That would be great.
That absolutely would be worthwhile.
Yeah, no, I think that would be great.
And if I have scanned a lot of material, such as some of the trade literature and so on, and you want that, I mean, I can give it to you. It's no pain because it's already done.
Great.
Is there anything else that you could think of that you would?
Well, I know that we're going to take some pictures.
Yeah.
But I think that we're all set with the recording. So I think...
Yeah, great.
I think that this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, yeah. Well, I enjoyed it. And, I think the let's go through some